As the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is Laws of Spiritual Success. Theosophy says that the whole universe is an orderly universe which is governed by law. And we see this happening in the small affairs of life. We see how the sun rises in the east, sets in the west, that is the ebb and flow of tides. You sow a seed of mango and it will give mango only and not brinjal or rose or anything else. Similarly, we see this law operating also in a human being at a physical level. You eat rotten food and you are going to have indigestion. Similarly, at a mental and psychic plane, you see that you've been watching trash serials or trash movies or reading trash books. It's going to corrupt your nature inwardly, and in your unguarded moment, you will find that this suddenly comes out. So also, there are laws governing one's spiritual or inner life. Now, in a way, what we are going to see through today's lecture is only a bird's eye view of what it is to follow spiritual discipline. It's a very exhaustive subject, something which you can't cover in some 40-45 minutes. Now, even before we see what are the laws, what is spiritual success in the first place? If we talk about, on the one hand, worldly success, all of us are able to define who is a successful man today, and we know, we would immediately say that it's a person who has got a lot of money, he has got power, position, a lot of wealth, comfort, and in a way you can also have the characteristics like he is someone who has a little bit of cunning, he is able to stand in this world of competition, and he can use other people as stepping stones. So we start describing a worldly successful man like this. Similarly, we can know spiritual success by knowing the characteristics of a person who is spiritually enlightened or spiritually successful. Of course, various traditions have ways of describing. In Buddhism, a spiritually enlightened person would be described as someone who is having Mahapradna and Mahakaruna, great spiritual insight and great spiritual wisdom. We may also add to it, it is the person who is having or experiencing unconditioned happiness, the happiness which is not dependent on anything. But of course, a simpler and a little more elaborate definition could be had through Bhagavad Gita. In chapter 12, when Sri Krishna gives us the description of a true bhakta, a true devotee, in a way, the description given is of a spiritually successful or a spiritually enlightened person, where he says, my devotee who is free from enmity, well disposed towards all creatures, merciful, wholly exempt from pride and selfishness, the same in pain and pleasure, patient of wrongs, contented, constantly devout, self-governed, firm in resolves, and whose mind and heart are fixed on me alone is dear unto me, and so on. There is a long description given, but this gives us still the idea of what it is to be spiritually successful. Now, in the light on the path, we've been told that if there is a gulf or distinction between a bad man and a good man, there is a greater gulf or distinction between a good man and a spiritual man. If you look at our lives, each one of us, we see that we pass this life in a kind of humdrum existence. Days pass into months, months into years, and in between you have activities like you sometimes go to the temple or church or synagogue or whatever it is. Then you may offer or do puja once, twice, depending upon the time available. You may be observing fasts, helping your neighbors and colleagues in the office, give out a little bit in charity from the surplus that we have. So if we, any of us is asked the opinion about ourselves, we feel, all in all, I'm a rather nice person. Some sort of a self-satisfaction and complacency is there about ourselves. But this, all of us, would fall into the category of being a good person. So, we can say that the very first law of spiritual success is the law of awareness. That awareness has to come about, that what I am and where I am, the life as that I am living, is not enough. There is something more to existence than the kind of life that I am living. And unfortunately, we see that this sort of awareness, this awakening comes only when there is a jolting experience in life. Some sort of a calamity in the family, some painful experience, and we are woken up. And we see, if we read the lives of various spiritually advanced people or saints, they would have undergone some experience like this. What comes to our mind is the life of the Gujarati saint poet, Akha Bhagat. Many might be familiar with his life, who was only a goldsmith. And when he was making jewelry as a goldsmith, he made once a gold necklace for his sister and gave it to her. Now, this sister did not trust him. So she took that gold necklace and got it tested with another goldsmith. Now, somehow Akha Bhagat, he came to know about this and he was shocked. And his whole idea of close human ties and human relationship was shattered. He was disillusioned about the close human relationships and the world as it was that he could see at his time. And then we are told how this brought about a change in his life, and then slowly and gradually he became a saint. For some, it could be a painful experience of this kind. For some, it could be a mere satiation which can wake him up. Many of us, we see, we are just madly rushing for pleasures of life. You have a car, you want the latest model of car. Then you are at a certain position, you are always aiming at becoming the chairman of the company. Then maybe you have so much money and you want your bank balance to be such and such. Then you try and get a membership of the elite club. You may be smoking the latest brand of cigarette. You may be having the wine which is of the really the foreign make and all that. But after having all this, you feel that you are going to be happy. If only I had this. But at the end of it, you still find that the happiness is still eluding. There is really no lasting happiness coming. So again, this can wake us up. Following and pursuing pleasures, as Buddha says, that most men run their rounds on this shore only. There is a kind of horizontal movement, but no vertical movement. And so, that is like crossing over the shore. And that is where the living of the spiritual life can begin. Now, if this kind of awakening is not only a sentimental flash of a moment, if really we have felt it, then the next question arises, why did this happen to me? And what is the purpose of life? So slowly and gradually, you want to realize that I am required to change myself. There is a mental and moral and a psychic change required. And then when you inquire further, you find that yes, there is actually a spiritual discipline with all its laws. Now having done this, this is the first step. The law, as we said, is of awareness. Having become aware, the next important thing is the law of learning. This learning, again, is at two planes. Learning so as to widen our horizon. We may be just knowing what our religion may be teaching, and therefore may be having very parochial and narrow ideas. But when we start reading the scriptures of other religions, books by the great people, lives of the great people, there is a widening of horizon. This is learning, but theoretically. But there is a greater learning, and that is learning from life. As Mr. Crosby says, that the purpose of life is to learn, and that it is all made up of learning. Again, we see that you may pass through the painful experience, but what happens when you pass through the painful experience? One, we just rebel. There is so much grumbling and murmuring, and we feel that we are the only unfortunate person in the whole world. And we grumble and grumble against God and against the very universe. Or we pass through that painful experience, and at the end of it you say that, oh, it was so nightmarish, I hope it will not repeat again. I want to forget all about it like a bad dream. That is about all. And still worse, what we do is, we are like a cat, as Mr. Crosby says in his Friendly Philosopher. When the cat is outside in the cold, she will mew and mew, she will scratch at the door to be brought in. But once inside, comfortable, cozy, she forgets all about that experience of cold night, and again she will mew to be taken outside. And we, human beings come perilously near to this situation. When we pass through that painful experience, maybe some enlightenment comes, but we go and repeat the same thing again and we are put into the same situation all over again. So the learning that is required, and that is why Light on the Path says that you need to pass through foul and clean places alike, that you need to pass through even most evil kind of experiences. We have to, not necessarily ourselves, but we should be able to understand and learn something from the wickedness and evil of the world. Because the virtue which is developed within the four walls of monastery, it is not a very strong virtue. As we can see, that a person who has been brought up in a monastery in a situation where he is not really coming in contact with women, he is not coming in contact with people who drink, people where you see in the slums how they beat their wives and that kind of atmosphere. Suddenly if he is thrown in that atmosphere, the result is that he is thrown off balance. He is shocked. He is not able to handle the situation. A spiritually advanced person, a spiritual person, is not shocked by evil. He is able to understand the evil and the wickedness of the world. And so, as someone has said, that I don't believe in fugitive and cloistered virtue. The beautiful story is by Somerset Maugham called Rain. In that, we are told of a missionary who is very puritanical, and there is a next door to him staying a prostitute. He's always looking down upon her, and once he feels very generous, so she thinks that I will reform her. So he approaches her, and the prostitute was realizing that what she did was not good. So she wholeheartedly surrenders herself to him to be, as it were, reformed. But what happens is that this missionary was, as it were, brought up in the four walls of monastery and was not exposed to this prostitution, women and things of that sort. Slowly he is getting charmed and he himself begins to slide in his discipline. Whereas the prostitute, of course, is still willing to be reformed by him. So this is what happens if we have not tried to understand evil and wickedness. There is something to be learned even from the sin, the evil and the wickedness of life. Now, this learning does not really happen only if you pass through the experience. As you see, the very first quotation in your hand says, learn to look intelligently into the hearts of men. From an absolutely impersonal point of view, otherwise, your sight is colored. No man is your enemy, no man is your friend, all alike are your teachers. All alike are your teachers. You can learn through what is called imaginative sympathy. There may be a blind person, a crippled person, and you need not go through that experience. If only your heart goes out, what does it feel like to be that person? Like in Uncle Tom's Cabin, there is a little girl who says, never had no mother, never had no father, I just growed. Now what it means to have no parents right from your childhood? We can put ourselves for a little while in the place of Topsy and see what it feels. And again, we can learn something from it. So, as Mr. Judge says in letters that have helped me, that if only you keep your eyes open and try to see the lives of other people, by living single life, you will have the advantage of having lived several lives because you are learning from their lives also. And there's a beautiful story, those who are familiar with this whole series of books called Chicken Soup for the Soul, it appears there that there is this person who is suffering from handicap of his legs. He's suddenly paralyzed or something. And at the end, when he goes through that experience, suddenly he begins to, as usual, grumble about life and his situation and all that. At the same time, he is feeling very proud that I am not dependent on anyone. At least I am able to do my things. And all that he is able to do is fit an engine in his car so that he can go to office and come back, do the office work. Now, as it happens, one day while he is coming back home, his car has a flat tire. Now, luckily for him, there is a cottage nearby. He honks the horn and a little girl comes running out. And he says that, look, I've got a flat tire, can you help me? And she goes in and comes out with a very old man. Now, the two of them say that, yes, we can do something, and half an hour they take in fixing his car tire. Now, of course, this man is very furious. Fixing a car tire, a job of 10-15 minutes, and these people are taking ages. But anyway, he just sits in And then after it is done, this old man and the little girl come to his window. And he feels generous. He feels that, okay, I must compensate them. So he takes out a $10 bill and holds it near that man. And the little girl says, he won't be able to take. You know, my grandpa is blind. And this really shocks him. Old man and blind and a little girl, the two of them have fixed my car tire. And here I was, I have just lost my feet and otherwise I'm hale and hearty and I'm grumbling with life and thinking that I'm doing something wonderful by just being self-dependent. And from that day onwards, he said, I made up my mind that I will help as many people as I can, just like this old blind man did. So there is, we can all multiply instances of this kind in our own lives, where we see another's life and the way in which they deal, it inspires and it makes us learn something out of it. So this is the law of learning. But this law of learning can happen, or learning can happen at all, if in the first place there is acceptance. So there is a law of acceptance. Most of the time, as we said, we grumble. And so long as we are grumbling, it is like Mr. Crosby says, you kick against the pricks. Only the pricks enjoy it. And this acceptance does not mean that it is fatalism. Oh, it's my kismat. What to do? It's not that. It simply means having faith in the law of karma. That whatever has come to me, it has come to me under the law of karma, which moves to righteousness. It moves and works justly and righteously. It would not have come to me if I did not deserve it. Maybe I can't see the reason for it in this life. Perhaps I did it in some one of the earlier lives. So once that acceptance comes, our mind becomes free to see, now what is it that I have to learn out of this? The second thing is, most important, is detachment. The law of detachment. Because what happens when we experience something, we are all immersed into that experience. Whether it is the most pleasurable experience or the most painful experience, we completely identify ourselves with it. Now, even before we come to this detachment part, it's interesting to see what HPB has to say about pain. In the second quotation, she says, and how can there be any change for the better without proportionate suffering during the preceding stage? Is it not those only who have learned the deceptive value of earthly hopes and illusive allurements of external nature who are destined to solve the great problems of life, pain and death? But the next one is more important, where Mr. Jat says, growth does not depend upon the amount of pain and pleasure that is endured, but upon our attitude of mind towards all that may meet us on life's journey. Our attitude of mind. Two people may go through the same experience, but one learns something out of it, the other just brushes it aside and is the same man in spite of that experience. So as they say, men are wise, not in proportion to their experience, but in proportion to their capacity for experience. This capacity for experience is ability to look at things and learn. Now, as we said, something that is required is detachment. It's only when we are detached that we are able to analyze things. We will find that as we become more and more detached, this time gap between experience and analysis becomes shorter and shorter. And a time comes when we would have experienced, if we tried practicing detachment, that even while you are having the experience, you are able to remain detached and observe. There is always some part in us which can remain detached and take the position of a witness, what we call as observing or having sakshi bhav. Just observing it, that some portion of me is involved in this pain or pleasure, but I am not that. And that is beautifully brought out in the next one, which is a quotation from one of the articles in Times of India, where it says, the thought pattern during the suffering hinges around, I am unhappy. In the state of unhappiness, what happens is that one's personality gets totally identified with one's emotional layer. The fact is that I can observe my body. I can also observe my emotions and my ideas. Now the exercise is to stand apart as a mere witness of the pain. If it is at the body level, of sorrow at the emotional level, an insult or non-acceptance of our ideas by others at the intellectual level. With a little continuation of this self-effort, one dissociates the I from the unhappiness. How long will the thoughts remain unhappy without the cooperation of the I? It is the mind that suffers, not I. The I has become a witness. And this is important for the process of learning. Now, as he said, the next important thing is detachment. Whenever we find that we are becoming, as it were, excessively dependent and unduly attached to something, some person, some place, it is time to tell ourselves that my happiness does not depend upon this thing, this person, this place. I can take it or leave it. Whenever we try to possess something, as we will see, we are possessed by that very thing. It must be experience of all of us that we are, supposing, very addicted to television. Some of us are great readers, so you have to have some books or some new books all the time or some articles to read. And in the absence of this, if the TV conks off for 2 days even, we begin to feel we have ceased to exist. I don't know what to do with my life. Such a vacuum is created. We are therefore possessed. We are held captive by these things upon which we depend. And so, the best way, in fact, the starting point for cultivating detachment could be that if you could look back on a day, and in a day, if you can count at least 4 to 5 times when you denied yourself some harmless pleasure, it could be something like this, that you like a particular serial, Saas Bhi Kabhi Bahu Thi, suppose. There is a great viewing for that, it seems. So, suppose you are very attached and you say, no, today I will not watch that serial, but I will take some serious reading, and purposely you in that half an hour do some serious reading. Or if you are very attached to having ice creams and you will say, no, I will not have that second helping of ice cream even though I like it. And so on, each one knows to what we feel slave to. And you can put a stop to that knowingly and purposefully in a day. Then slowly we will begin to practice this. Somewhere we will reach on the path of detachment. And also we notice that the more things we require for becoming happy, the more are the occasions for feeling disappointed. The story is there of a king who wanted to know that who is the happiest person in his kingdom. So he sent out people in all directions and he said that you get me a shirt of the person who is the happiest in my kingdom. So the people went in all corners and they found, of course, somewhere or the other people were unhappy. They didn't have this, they didn't have that. Finally they did come across a village boy who was absolutely happy. And when they looked at him, they found he had no shirt to wear. So, happiness, as we can see, is an attitude of mind. And what goes with it is contentment. Now, with this, we can also have a look at what the lady called Peace Pilgrim has to say about this law of detachment. She says, no one is truly free who is still attached to material things or to places or to people. We must be able to use things when we need them and then relinquish them without regret when they have outlived their usefulness. We must be able to appreciate and enjoy the places where we tarry and yet pass on without anguish when we are called elsewhere. We must be able to live in loving association with people without feeling that we possess them and must run their lives. Anything that you strive to hold captive will hold you captive. And if you desire freedom, you must give freedom. So this is the law of detachment. Now another thing which comes to the mind is the law of purification. Purification at various levels. Purification of the body, purification of thoughts, purification of desires, purification of speech. Now, bodily purification, we are well. In fact, now undue emphasis we are giving to it as to being very careful as to what diet I will take and having a lot of fresh air, exercises, so that almost 3/4 of our attention is towards the body only. But there is also purification of thought. In fact, very central to the spiritual life is mind and thoughts. We know that all pain, pleasure, troubles, anything you say, it starts with mind. We say the fight is in the mind. And so the thoughts need to be observed. Of course, it's very easy to know that the thoughts generally, the first thing again, as we said, the very first law is the law of awareness. It finds its application even here. First thing is to become aware of what kind of thoughts generally occupy my mind. And we will see more often than not what are the thoughts you are thinking about yourself, planning as to what you will wear, what you will eat, what you will do. Or it will be thoughts of, he did like this to me and now next I meet him, I am going to give him back. Some such thing, criticizing another, judging another person, trying to make money or he is making money or whatever it is. So there is judgmental thoughts. Or thoughts of envy, jealousy, hatred, anger. And these are one kind of thoughts which occupy our mind. But of course, we may become even aware and may want to rectify. But there is more dangerous thoughts, and these are the thoughts of anxiety and worry. These really eat away the people of the day to day. As you know, which man is free from worry and anxiety? With a fast life and with all this ambition that we have, each one is really anxious and worrisome about something or the other which he wants to achieve or his child wants to achieve. And one way or another, these thoughts occupy our mind. And this is something which we need to get rid of. These are the negative thoughts which come as an obstacle in the way. And as Mr. Judge says, that anxiety, it doesn't fetch us anything. Don't try to cross the bridge even before you have arrived at it. Tomorrow is the exam and I start worrying, what will happen supposing I forget all that I have read? Or if suddenly there is a train strike or the train will stop in between the two stations, as with something which happens very, very, very frequently in Bombay. So by such anxiety and worry beforehand, he says, you put an invisible occult obstacle in the path of what you want to get done. We are not aware that by thinking like this, actually you are putting an obstacle which was not there, but now you have put it in the path of something which you want to get done. So anxious thought also need to be really gotten rid of. The thing to do then is to replace these negative thoughts by the positive thoughts. Now this is again the sadhana of the whole life. If we are always in continuously in companionship of good scriptures, good books, then you have certain things learned by heart. There are certain quotations, there are certain good sayings. As soon as these thoughts come, we can replace it by these good shlokas or good quotations which we have read. And so, the law is that two different thoughts cannot occupy the mind at the same time. That is the law of mind. And this is what we find in the book, The Power of Positive Thinking, that when the mind is emptied, something is bound to enter. Start filling your mind with creative and healthy thoughts. Then when the old fears, hates and worries that have haunted you for so long try to edge back in, they will in effect find a sign on your door of your mind reading occupied. They may struggle for admission, but the new and healthy thoughts which you have taken in will now be stronger and better fortified and therefore be able to repulse them. So that is the whole technique of repulsing the negative kind of thoughts. Now, also there is purification of desires. We won't be able to dwell much on it. Sometimes we've had a full lecture on all these aspects. But of course, it is very easy to see what kind of desires we have. It is again, very personal desires of our progress, our aggrandizement, our good, or our children, our family's welfare. These are the kind of desires we have. Whereas the desire ultimately which we must have is not only for our own spiritual progress, but so that we become better able to help and teach the whole of humanity. It is only for the welfare of humanity. That is the highest kind of desire. Of course, this again happens step by step, the purification of desire. And then lastly is the purification of speech in this whole sequence of purifications. Now, speech is something very, very important. Now again, it is obvious to see, just like we observe our thoughts, if we observe our speech, we find what happens when two people meet. They will talk about some other people. They will talk about what was cooked at home and what happened in the family. And of course, this is sometimes necessary to be exchanging some information and news. But how much of our time is spent in speaking only about these things? So, speech. And most of the time, of course, we are condemning or judging another. And so the laws of Manu say that a good thing in regard to control of speech is from the laws of Manu. The rule of speech is given as, let him say what is true. Let him say what is useful. Let him say what is pleasant. Let him utter no disagreeable truth. Let him utter no agreeable falsehood. Again, we won't be able to elaborate on this, but it is self-evident what kind of speech is recommended. Most importantly, it should be a useful and beneficial speech. As Carlyle says, he actually is at pains and he says, I beseech thee, I pray to you, that don't speak unless your thought has silently matured. Do not speak unless, only if you have only mad and mad-making noises to emit. What we are generally speaking, he calls it as mad and mad-making noises to emit. Keep silent. So unless we have something useful to say, we should prefer to keep silent. Because speech is one of the avenues through which the divine or creative energy in man is laid to waste. The other avenue is what we call the sexual activities through which man's creative energy is wasted. And another avenue is this avenue of speech, where through useless speech you are wasting away the creative energy instead of, as it were, conserving, which you can then use at a higher level. And therefore, for a person who desires spiritual success, what is most important is periodical observance of silence. That you must observe silence at least a few minutes in a day. And this should be right kind of silence. We sometimes see people observe silence, but then they will converse by writing on chits of paper. What is the use of that silence? Still worse, if you have ever seen in a joint family, the mother-in-law will be observing silence always every day for some half an hour in the morning. And what will she do? She will be gesticulating, and through sign language she will be telling the daughter-in-law, now put the cooker, now look at the child, now do this. And sometimes there will be miscommunication, the daughter-in-law won't understand, and there is chaos and agitation in her mind and the daughter-in-law's mind. Is this silence? Silence is really silencing the behavior of the lower mind. Because our mind is chattering all the time. Something or the other, the mind is never empty. Some thoughts or the other keep coming. So silencing the behavior of the lower mind is what is silence. You can see if two people are there, and so long as you keep talking, you can't know what the other person wants to say. So also there is in man that God sitting within silently to convey something, to guide us, to help us. But how can we know what this God wants to say if we don't still our mind? If we don't keep silent even for 10 minutes, no communication can take place with our divine or higher nature within. So, silence. And it is not as if you can't communication through silence is not possible. In fact, as you rise spiritually, the communication takes place through silence. There is a Dakshinamurti Stotra which says that there are disciples who are sitting and they are old. The guru is a young man. The teaching is silence. And yet, the doubts of the disciples have been dispelled. The communication through silence is possible. And we do experience this, that when you really feel for the suffering of another person from the heart, you can see that something warm and comforting spills from your heart and it is felt by that person. You don't have to say anything to him. The mother is sitting near that bedside of that sick child. She doesn't go on saying, oh my darling, now how are you feeling, this, that. She just sits there. And yet, the child feels that warmth which is there in the mother, just silently sitting side by side. So this silence is something which is very important in the spiritual life. Now the next thing we can say is the law of self-reliance. Again, self-reliance is at two levels. Just at the physical level, there is a self-reliance in the sense in which Mr. Crosby says, find out where your things are and get them for yourselves. Don't ask another to do something which you can do for yourself. You are of value only when you can help another and not when you require help yourself. This is something we have to learn by heart. At a very simple level, it's very important that we do our things on our own and not really depend on someone. Self-reliance at one level, but on a higher level, there is self-reliance in the sense of relying only on our own judgment. Many times we feel that it's my opinion. So there may be the crisis like what is going on about Hindutva now. And we will give our opinion saying that I feel like this about this particular political, economic or social crisis. But really if you look deep down, are those your thoughts? This is very well explained by Eric Fromm in his book called The Fear of Freedom, where he says that there is very little of original thinking really. Most of the time what we call our ideas are something we have grasped through reading an editorial in the newspaper or through the magazines or somebody leading in that field and which we have just absorbed as our ideas, not really giving it a good thought. Similarly, when it comes to choosing a career, what happens? I want to become a model, I want to become a doctor or an engineer. Now, really again, he says you pause and ask yourself, do I want to become engineer, doctor or model or whatever it is? No, I want which I am supposed to want. In a way, what we do is conform. Conform to the majority, what is being done by the majority. We want the approval of the society. If the society is doing one thing, we also want to do the very thing. So there is no such thing as self-reliance, self-judgment or self-independence in that sense. But that, of course, it may not be very important in these small matters, but it is very, very important when you are trying to live the spiritual life. When it is a question of making a moral choice, then are you going to follow what the other people are doing? There was a time when untouchability was being practiced. Now, just because a whole lot of Hindus were practicing untouchability, is it necessary that I should practice untouchability? Or even today, in the name of Hindutva, if they are creating a gulf between Muslims and Hindu, should I just get carried away because a large part of Hindus are there and they all are of the opinion that the Hindu interest should be taken care of? Or should we really exercise our judgment? And that kind of a correct judgment can come when we learn to turn within. There are 1001 voices impinging on us. But finally, the final authority has to be that voice within. And we are told that it doesn't matter if you go wrong, you make a mistake in your judgment, but you have to learn to rely on that inner voice, which will finally guide you in the right direction. So, there is this thing about self-reliance. And lastly, of course, there is the most important law, which we can say, as it were, forms the very core, the very soul of spiritual living, and that is the law of non-separateness, law of love, law of giving, law of compassion, call it by what name you will. In the Dhammapada, Buddha says, enmity is never appeased by enmity, it is ever appeased by love. This is the law eternal, he says. What happens? Why are we feeling this sort of a separateness and this sort of inimical feeling towards each other? Again, at the base of it, there is this ego or pride which comes as an obstacle in the way. How much is this sense of egotism? It is said that in living the spiritual life, the last thing which we are able to conquer is our ego. It is the last foe which we can conquer. And we see, each one of us can really introspect and he will find that we always want to be placed, as it were, at the center. Then other things and other people should arrange around ourselves, like the iron filings, they form a pattern around a magnet. Our interest only should be taken care of. But why? Other people have their own interest. We have our interest. And they come in conflict with each other. And then the whole problem arises. Small thing where our ego is injured and it causes unhappiness. Very small things. If we look, we find that our inability to buy an expensive coat or a sari, it makes us unhappy. Our inability to, as it were, get promotion in the office and we become unhappy. Our inability, and when we are not praised and someone else is praised and considered more intellectual or more good and we become unhappy. So there are these small reasons. At the center of it all, there is the ego and the pride. We give exaggerated importance to ourselves. And just 2 Sundays back we saw, in letters that have helped me, Mr. Jat says, learn that you are a very small affair in this world. If you are gone, people are not going to miss you. Somebody else will take your place and the world's work will carry on. So this is what we have to realize, that we are not so important. In the statistics, they have a normal curve which is bell-shaped. Now what does it indicate? A bell-shaped curve like this shows, it tapers on 2 sides and it shows that extremely good and extremely bad people are very few. Most of us, let us say, are mediocres. Average people falling in the middle region. So why should we feel that we are someone really great or and ought to be really paid a lot of attention, etc., etc.? The opposite of it is, therefore, learn to think away from ourselves. Let us see that our mind is occupied with not thoughts and problems of ourselves, but as far as possible, problems and needs and worries of other people who are around us. And that is where the law of giving, the law of charity, the law of love begins. And we are told that, really speaking, worshipping the God externally in any manner is not so important. Self-knowledge is of loving deeds the child. It is the child of loving deeds. That wisdom that we are talking about will come when we engage ourselves in loving deeds. We also say that selfless service is worship. There is a very moving story by Leo Tolstoy regarding this. It just drives home the point regarding our relationship with God, humanity, and as it were us. The story is about, probably you are familiar with it, is about a very humble shoemaker called Martin. The setting is in Russia, where he is having his little workshop in a basement. And there is a small little window from which he can see not the people, but only the feet of the people who are passing by. Now he is working and he's lost his wife, and then he also loses his child. And as we saw in the law of awareness, it is then that he suddenly turns to reading the Bible. And when he reads the Bible, he comes across a passage where he sees that Jesus, when he went to the Pharisees did not receive him properly, not even entertain him as a guest should be. And further on, Bible said that all ye who say, Lord, Lord, but not do the things that are required of you, you are like people who are building a home on sand without a solid foundation. That it's no use saying God, God, or even say performing a lot of rituals and sacrifices and do worship and puja, but do what you are required to do. And he sat thinking and he felt that perhaps these Pharisees were like me. I have also in my life never thought of anybody else. I have so far not entertained a single guest. And then he said, but suppose now I want to change. Would Jesus come to me? And there was a voice heard, and a voice said, look out for me in the street tomorrow and I will be there. So then he starts working. Of course, he thinks it's a fancy, but still he's hoping and all the time looking at the window the next day, looking at the, he knows the town people by their shoes. So whenever he would see new shoes, he would look at the face to see whether Jesus has come. And as it happens, there is a sweeper who comes there. He's very feeling very cold and all that, uncomfortable. He takes him in, gives him tea, makes him warm, then again starts his work. Then there is again a woman with a little child, and the child is crying and the woman is uncomfortable. Again his heart goes out. He stops his work, brings them in, gives the milk and a coat, makes them comfortable and let them go. Then there is an old lady and a little boy who is trying to steal the apple, and the lady is trying to hit him. He tries to make truce between them and, as it were, bids them goodbye happily and again works. The end of the day comes and no Jesus is coming. He's very disappointed. But Jesus said, a voice was heard that he will come. And then when he is about to open and read the Bible, he sees the shadow of the sweeper. And the shadow of the sweeper is smiling and saying, it is I, and disappears. Then that little child and the woman comes in a shadow form again, smiling and happy. They say, it is I. Then again, there is this old lady and the little boy comes again, says, it is I. And then he reads the Bible. What does he read? The Bible opens at the page which says, for I was hungry and ye gave me meat. You won't find this in your leaflet. I was thirsty and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger and ye took me in. In as much as you have done it unto one of these least of my brethren, ye have done it unto me. That whenever you help these people, that little child or the sweeper or that boy or the lady, you have served me. You have worshipped me in worshipping and helping them. So this is the path. The law of giving is of paramount importance in the law of spiritual success. We would like to close this with what is given by Mr. Judge in two different places in letters that have helped me. Act with a high motive. Have kindly feeling towards all. Do some little act of kindness every day and try to realize that the end of all this will be happiness and peace to all humanity. Then a foretaste of that peace will enter your heart. There is a bright side to life, and what makes the brightness is the love which each of us may have for humanity. The reason you have helped in this life, the reason you have had help is that in other lives you gave it to others. In every effort you made to lighten another mind and open it to truth, you were helped yourself. Those pearls you found for another and gave it to him, you really retained for yourself in the act of benevolence. For when one lives thus to help others, he is thereby putting in practice the rule to try and kill out all sense of separateness, and thus gets little by little in possession of true light. Friends, we have now a few minutes for questions on this subject. This is a very important question. Is there any conflict between the worldly success and spiritual success? Well, it all depends upon what we describe as worldly success. If by worldly success, if we mean what was described in the beginning of the lecture, that you want to have a lot of money, you want to have a very high position, and you want name and fame, then yes, there is going to be conflict